So they showed me a film in March 2018 called Resilience, which was all about the impact of childhood trauma on the developing brain, and about toxic stress, and about how biologically it changed people, and how a lot of people became addicted to substances from abuse, and how they were quick to anger. And in that hour-long film, I suddenly realised at that point I'd been failing all of the people I'd been dealing with, because probably 95% of my business stems from trauma. And as a consequence of the trauma, people become addicted to substances, or they're quick to anger, and they do things that they probably shouldn't and that the society disapproves of.
Welcome to Cali Corner, Ian. It's great to have you on, mate. I invited you after seeing something you'd actually posted on LinkedIn that really struck a chord with me personally. Effectively, with you successfully managed to persuade a judge to grant one of your clients who had unfortunately suffered a lot of trauma in her life liberty for good behaviour, and that's what really made me want to speak to you effectively.
Right, sure. That's kind of you having me on. I'm pleased to be on, and it was good to visit Cali Uni a few weeks ago with Dr. Caroline Bruce and Melissa Rutherford, and seen some of the law students there and other students in the campus. So very good setup. So glad to join you.
Aye, no, I went to Cali, and they're kind of rebranding as the University for Common Good, and I would definitely sort of support them in that endeavour. I think they do a lot of work with sort of working class kids and people from working class communities, which is a kind of cause that's close to my heart. So aye, big up to Glasgow Cali, definitely.
Close to my heart too. So yeah, lots of clever lawyers from fancy universities with the very little practical skills and a little experience in the real world, and often they don't necessarily make, certainly for the best criminal lawyers, but for the best lawyers and people who have maybe seen a wee bit of life, even hardship, often I think become very good lawyers. And if that's a pathway for kids from the Cali University, as I say, certainly it wouldn't put me off employing anybody. If anything, it would probably encourage me to do so.
Right, no, that's amazing to hear. I think the only thing I would say to that is I don't think that's a problem that just affects the legal profession, unfortunately. I think that's something that is seeping into other industries, especially like politics and things like that. I would make that argument for there. And I've watched a couple of other podcasts with people that you're sort of affiliated with, and it was James Doggett actually that sort of said people that have experienced trauma get really good bullshit detectors, and that's something that really resonated with me. So I think that just because you've experienced trauma in your life, I don't think it means that you, it certainly doesn't mean you can't be a success. I think there's countless examples of, you know, people across various fields who have excelled and, you know, went on to be live great lives and protectors of people and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a lot to be said for those who come, not saying come out unscathed, but who can come out of the other side, show great resilience if they've experienced difficulties in their life, that they are well equipped to deal with, you know, certainly with the work I do, and probably better equipped than a lot of other people. So I wouldn't wish that on someone, obviously. I wouldn't wish them to have had hardship in their life, but people who manage to fight their way through it, I think that experience in my world is a huge value, because they're more empathetic, often more compassionate, sometimes not, as I've experienced now and again, that it can be the opposite effect on people who have suffered hardship, that, well, if I made it, and, you know, how are they taking drugs and alcohol, and they've chosen to live that life, I've experienced the same hardship, and I wouldn't behave that way. Doesn't always, as I say, there's no straight line, I think, with trauma.
No, absolutely. I would agree with that. So we kind of missed the introduction, Ian. So the way I would introduce you effectively would be as a sort of trauma-informed defence lawyer. And obviously we can explain what that means as we go on here. But you've won several awards over the years for your contributions. But I think for your story specifically, given where you've came from and what looks to me on the outside, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, is a wee bit of a shift in your life's philosophy. Can we maybe talk about your upbringing firstly, if that's all right, your parents, schooling, all that sort of stuff, and then we can go from there?
Sure. I grew up in Craigshill, which is an area in Livingston, very working class area, but I probably wouldn't describe my upbringing as a hard upbringing. My dad was a local policeman. My mum worked, she was a legal cashier. So in terms of my peers, I probably was quite privileged growing up, and how my family was structured and how I was brought up. So I wouldn't claim a lot of hardship, but I certainly witnessed it. And looking back, effectively with trauma-informed eyes, you know, I was probably witnessing huge sexual abuse, physical abuse of my classmates, and not realising that's what it was. And in some ways, obviously, that made my childhood easier, not really knowing these things, but looking back on it, thinking of people who went on to be bullies and taking drugs and addicted to alcohol, I was probably surrounded by that. Livingston was a hub for a lot of what we would describe as broken families from Glasgow and Edinburgh. So the overflow of people who were divorced or separated would be housed in Livingston. But as an upbringing, as a place to go as a kid, I had a quite a happy childhood, I guess. What I didn't know and what I know now in terms of my own, I guess, loosely speaking, trauma or stress, is that growing up I was dyslexic and I'd mask that by trying to have a laugh and be funny, by working very, very hard because I didn't really know why I was in quotations thick and how my brain couldn't really understand it or work quickly with reading and writing and that type of thing. But looking back, that was probably my stress and my worry, but when I didn't really know or understand, and I didn't find it out until about 10 years ago when my son was diagnosed with dyslexia. So my schooling was hard, but my life and happiness was generally pretty good. Like sport, loved all that. As I say, pretty trouble-free upbringing, but as I say, surrounded by a lot of people who were struggling.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You mentioned the dyslexia there. Have you ever speculated if that experience has sort of had any impact on this sort of segue into being a trauma-informed lawyer at all?
Yeah, I think loosely, as I say, I'm not trying to compare someone who's got dyslexia with someone who was abused as a child. The comparison's not really there. What probably is there is a high level of stress of being subjected to every time I went to school, thinking and feeling worried, not feeling not good enough, going to university, feeling as if I was stupid, wondering why I was in the library till 10 o'clock every night with my pals, or leaving it at 6 to go to the pub, and thinking to myself, A, that they hadn't read it or they weren't interested, but not realising I was probably having to read every word of every page because I thought that's how you read. Yeah, so looking back, I think it allowed me to have a level of empathy with understanding my own stress and worries that, as I say, I didn't understand why they were there. And actually, it was a relief to know that I was dyslexic because it made me think, well, actually, good for me to plough my way through university, to get on. And I now view it, a lot of people talk about this, but I now view it as a strength. I think differently, I do things differently. Not always in a good way, but it certainly has changed my path. But it's certainly one of the reasons I think I got involved in the trauma-informed and trauma-aware work that I'm trying to do now. It was a strange sort of segue into that in 2017, which I can tell you about, but it didn't just come from dyslexia or empathy, that's for sure.
No, I think that will resonate with a lot of listeners, what you're sort of saying there. I've did a wee bit of training about how obviously dyslexia can affect people, and what you're describing there is no unique. It's a sort of shared experience, so I think it's definitely useful. And I seen something recently, actually. It was they'd done a study of entrepreneurs, and they were saying it was something 40% or 50% of whoever participated in the study were actually sort of dyslexic. So you're saying, it can be a strength in terms of that ability to sort of think outside the box and how you process and translate information. So I found that kind of an interesting stat.
Definitely. It's something I look back on thinking, if I'd known I was dyslexic when I was young, would I have maybe just said, well, I can't do that because I'm dyslexic, as opposed to saying, I don't know what's wrong, I'm going to find ways of getting around this difficulty by working extra hard, or dealing with things in a way that I had to adapt and overcome, which I think is a good thing, but is a struggle. And for some people, probably that struggle overwhelms them. And as I say, they go down maybe different routes.
Aye, no, absolutely. Can we talk a wee bit about your own route then? Just, I'm keen to hear that. You mentioned sort of university there. So when you went to university and you started to study law, and then you sort of took your first job, what was the sort of ambition or intentions, I suppose? Did you start in defence, sort of criminal law straight away, or were you doing something else?
And then I couldn't get a job in criminal law. So when I was 15, I met a guy called Jim Keegan, who's now one of the top solicitor advocates. He's King's Counsel. He is the Keegan part of my business, Keegan Smith. When I was 15, I went into his office and my dad had set up the meeting. He knew him because he was a local cop. And he says, oh, your dad tells me you want to be a lawyer. Well, this is what you're going to do. You're going to do a law degree, and then you're going to become an accountant, and you'll be a successful businessman. And that's what I'd advise you to do. And I told him, no, I'm going to be a criminal lawyer just like you. And they booted me out of the office. And about 10 or 11 years later, I became his business partner. So that was my journey into becoming a criminal lawyer. But I got a traineeship with a firm called Skeen Edwards and Garson, which was where Robert Louis Stevenson did his training. It was a very posh firm, private clients, not really legal aid work, not criminal work, not really dealing with the man in the street. And I enjoyed it. It was a very good learning. I learned many things that were positive, but I learned ways of thinking, well, I don't like the way you're doing that. I don't like that. So you can learn, I think, as much from how not to do something as you can from how to do it. And then after that, after my traineeship, as I say, I ended up going to work for Jim Keegan. And then in 1998, we set up our own business. And we've been going since, over 25 years as a criminal defence lawyer.
I know, that's an interesting story. So when you had went away and you did your law degree, did you have any more interactions with it? So I forget his name there, but your partner? Or was it the first time you met again when you came back into the office?
Not really. I didn't really meet, but I obviously knew who he was, and I was following some of the cases he was involved in. And then when I did my traineeship, I went to work at his firm as an assistant. And as I say, we sort of branched off from the firm he was in and set up in 1998, and almost immediately gained through him ultimately some very big high profile cases, murder cases, high profile drugs cases, and the business just really went from there. But that was so in the early days. So probably as a youngish lawyer, I was doing a variety of work, mostly court work, but it included divorces, compensation claims, children's hearings. We did sports contracts for Scottish rugby players. And then the focus for me then became on only criminal law. And in 2017, years later, having witnessed clients taking drugs, addicted to alcohol, getting violent, just thinking, you know, they've chosen a path to go down and what a bad lifestyle choice, or they were brought up badly. But in 2017, I met a lady called Leslie Udwin. And Leslie Udwin, as it turns out, was voted by the New York Times magazine as the second most impactful woman on the planet behind Hillary Clinton. And what she did was she was a filmmaker. She was a producer of East is East and won a BAFTA for that. But then in 2015, she created a documentary about the horrible, horrific death of a young doctor called Jota Singh. And she was murdered on a bus by six men, sexually abused and murdered. And Leslie created this film called India's Daughter, which gained worldwide repute and various awards. And she realised then that people, in general terms, had been brought up in ways to be misogynistic, to treat women very badly, to do a variety of things in society which were wrong. And a lot of it came from education and how society accepted certain things. And in particular, not just for India, but for our society as well, how there was a lack of equality for women. And she created a charity called Think Equal. And it was all about social emotional learning in early years. And her view was a wee bit like Mandela, that if children could be taught to hate, then they could also be taught to love and be kind and do other things which were better for society as well as individual. So I met her really by accident. I ran a small community cinema, and she said she was going to come up and stay with me. And I thought, all right, this is interesting. But she demanded that I created a meeting with her, with the First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, the Education Minister, the Justice Minister, the Early Years Minister. And I said, look, I'm just a wee guffy lawyer from Livingston. I don't know any of these people. What I ended up doing was, probably through dyslexia, thinking a little bit out of the box, to ask these important people if they wanted to meet her by explaining to them that she was the second most impactful woman on the planet, as per the New York Times magazine, that her ambassadors were Meryl Streep, Susan Sarandon, Emma Thompson. And suddenly that hook drew these people in, and she started meeting them. And through her, I got to meet Karen McCloskey, John Carnick, and another people from the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit. And basically, they questioned me as to, well, what's in this for you? What are you doing? And I said, well, I'm not doing anything. I'm just a jobbing lawyer out in Livingston. So they showed me a film in March 2018 called Resilience, which was all about the impact of childhood trauma on the developing brain, and about toxic stress, and about how biologically it changed people, and how a lot of people became addicted to substances from abuse, and how they were quick to anger. And in that hour-long film, I suddenly realised at that point that I'd been failing all of the people I'd been dealing with, because probably 95% of my business stems from trauma. And as a consequence of the trauma, people become addicted to substances, or they're quick to anger, and they do things that they probably shouldn't and that the society disapproves of. But we were always struggling as being personally responsible for their behaviours, because it's easier to do that. And once you treat people as responsible for their behaviours, we can punish them because it's their own fault, it's their choice. But when in fact, if you know that underneath behaviours, that in fact we as a society have failed those children, in a conservative way, what we would do is simply blame the parents. But as a society, children who've been failed by being sexually abused, being neglected, being battered, being treated in ways that inflict horrendous scars on them mentally. And if we accept that in part has a massive impact on how they then live their lives, then I think as a society we're responsible. And once we know that, then we should start treating people a bit differently. So that's what happened to me in March 2008. I had a little bit of an epiphany about who my clients were and what was going on as a result of education by others to me to explain to me that what was going on. And I suddenly thought, how the hell have I not known that for the past 25 years? And my second thought was, I'm going to have to tell everybody about this. And that was a journey that I took.
There's loads to unpack there. Leslie Mudwin sounds like a phenomenal person and a very interesting sort of hook there, as you've sort of explained it, the second most influential person in the world. So that's amazing. One thing that I did pick up there though was you sort of mentioned the education piece, right? So my own experience, so I will share a bit here, is I've sort of recently been diagnosed with PTSD, and it's something that I've only sort of really in the past few years started to understand, like, and sort of self-diagnose myself effectively through seeking out podcasts and watching TV and all that sort of stuff. But I think subconsciously I was always like aware of it, but how trauma can impact a person. And I think it made me sort of kind of empathetic for a sort of early age, because I understood, what the opposite side of that was, and I'd sort of faced evil and sort of thought, I'm never, that will never be me, sort of thing. So at what age do you think that we should, as a society, start sort of, like, I've got a kid, right, he's only six, when do we start talking to kids about, what would be a symptom of trauma, or what trauma could sort of be like? At what stage should we start introducing this to sort of education system? Because when I can only talk from my own personal experience, when I was at school, talked about bullying and things like that, but I can't remember the word trauma ever being sort of mentioned in the classroom.
So obviously I'm a lawyer, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an educationalist, but in terms of what Leslie does, so bizarrely in January, Leslie's been talking about this for a number of years, and she has placed her toolkit, her educational toolkit around the world. So there's numerous countries that have adopted it, including Canada, a lot of African countries, Indian speaking countries, and they use this toolkit, which is early years social emotional learning. Now, it's not a case that you talk to children about trauma and about sexual abuse at all. All these horrific things is gentle learning, and it usually happens from age of 2 or 3 in early years to about the age of 6 or 7. So obviously different countries and nursery schemes are much different from us. We educate our kids very early, formally educate them very early, age of 4 or 5. In Scandinavian countries, other countries, it sometimes doesn't happen until they're 6 or 7. But during the early years, where the brain is very malleable, in a very soft and gentle way, the Think Equal program, it basically introduces concepts about equality by story and play. So it's very soft and very gentle, and it's very successful. Bizarrely, Manchester, through Andy Burnham, have adopted the Think Equal programme in early years at nursery schools. But in January of this year, at Glasgow Council, have adopted, as part of their toolkit and programme, the Think Equal programme. And we're hoping it will be rolled out in the whole of Scotland very soon. So that's the age group, but it's not a case of talking to children about trauma. It's effectively arming them with a way of thinking which is different from perhaps how their parents think or how the bad influences think about what is good and what is bad, and what life would look like in a way that if we treated men and women the same rather than disparaging towards women, viewing them in the workplace. For example, we're 50-50 in terms of male and female who graduate in law. It's maybe even slightly higher, but still we have the vast majority of judges are male, for example, in our system. I think it's 5-1 or 4-1 are male. And we just go along with that because we think that's okay, when in fact, the probable, I don't think it is okay. And children at an early age are very gently provided information which we might not get. That doesn't stop abuse. It doesn't stop childhood trauma, but it might allow them to understand there's a different path, so that when their brains are developing, that they get information there which won't necessarily stop trauma. But if you think then they go on to become parents hopefully they don't do the things that are inflicted by the adults in their life, which are bad and cruel. That's certainly the theory, but I don't think you need to worry about talking to your six-year-old about trauma and the impact of adverse childhood experience. I wouldn't suggest that. And even for teens, to throw them into that, again, there's probably gentle ways of doing that without it being spoken about in a very formal way, if that makes sense. The reality is, for me, what we did early on, adopters of getting lawyers to understand, we targeted the students and we gave lectures to law students to explain the impact of trauma. Now, that is not on the assumption that none of these students have been affected by trauma, because they probably have. And the worry for some theorists are, you can't really talk about the impact of trauma because that might trigger someone. Now, that's on the assumption that someone who's been traumatised either doesn't know that they've been traumatised, which very rarely happens, or that it's going to cause them to kill themselves because we're talking about it. I don't think these things are necessarily follow what would be of comfort to someone who is addicted to drugs and alcohol, who's quick to temper. They think they're a bad person. They're aware that what has happened to them, rather than how they behave, that actually it's not really their fault. It actually comes from a soul independent of them, which in any other walk of life would be seen as cruel. So if you're causing children a lot of trauma and their outcome from that, it's not inevitable, but the outcome of that might be they take drugs or behave badly, that they are seen as a bad kid, and in their own heads that they are bad. With the explanation of understanding about trauma, they will realise they are not bad, that the things that have happened to them may create bad things around them, but they are not bad. And that's how I view my clients. So however badly behaved they may be, it's not acceptable to behave badly, that there might be an explanation rather than an excuse. And I think that's really important for everybody to know, including the people most affected by it.
I would agree with that. I think what I was trying to talk about, and probably quite badly with my sort of choice of words, was more along the lines of, like, if my son will say to me, or so-and-so was playing up at lunch today, or they hit this person, or they hit me, and I was like, well, you don't know, you know, what's going on in his life. Maybe he's had a bad day, his granny could be sick, and all that kind of stuff. I think I was meaning that kind of sort of teaching. You know, obviously you wouldn't be teaching them about stuff that are graphic, but I think things like that wouldn't have been taught to me as a child. It wouldn't have been on my parents' radar, probably, just because of the generation that they lived in. But I think as we are getting access to more and more information and we start to understand things like this, then there's opportunities there to sort of slowly introduce people to sort of, you mentioned it earlier, you know, that trauma can sort of biologically sort of change people. So if we can have, you know, our kids being aware of this, they can maybe help their own sort of classmates who might be going through, you know, traumatic stuff without even sort of realising it.
Yeah, that example you gave is a real life example. If children are witnessing other children bullying, then the question, it would be, you know, the old question is, what's wrong with them? There's something, they're bad. But if you start reframing that into, well, what's happened to that person for them to behave that way, it becomes a different way of looking at the person and how you see them and how you treat them. It could be probably from a point of view, if you call them a bully, that could be quite disarming for them to be seen in a way that is empathetic, because, you know, we can all picture someone at school that bullied, but we probably didn't ask the question or think about what was going on with them that they were behaving that way, because probably at the back of it, there was some bad stuff going on. You know, I don't think I've met many people who are naturally bad, in quotations, or evil, because those that probably would be diagnosed as being viewed that way are, have got massive, massive, deep-seated psychiatric conditions. You know, sociopaths, psychopaths, They're not well. I mean, we can view them and call them evil, but you know, the darkness in them is not something that they can really help. Other people who do bad things, we can say, well, they couldn't and probably should not behave that way, but there's usually reasons behind it as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just once, I'll use your phrase from earlier then, once you had this sort of epiphany and you started to seek this information, you know, about trauma and how it affects people's behaviour further, like, how's that changed you in terms of how you interact with people, both personally and professionally, when you're representing your clients?
Yeah, so I think I see things. So I went to dinner, James Docherty, who you mentioned earlier. I had very early on, I met James, and we were doing screenings of this film, Resilience, that I spoke to you about. I met Suzanne Zeedijk, and I met other people who are in this arena talking about trauma. And they said around the dinner table that, so this might sound a bit weird, but you know, not only can sense when someone's had traumatic issues, but I can almost sense to some extent what those might be. And I didn't quite laugh at them, but I remember thinking it was the most sort of ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. But I now I now understand it a lot more, because often clients will say, I don't know why I'm telling you this. See, when I was 8, see, when I was 12, you're not going to believe this, but and I know what's coming. I know what they're going to tell me, and it almost inevitably will be that they were sexually abused. Now, that's not to say everyone who suffers trauma is to do with sexual abuse, but the high numbers, I mean, we see in our criminal courts just the tip of the iceberg of the horrors that men and women, boys and girls suffer in terms of the levels of sexual abuse and sexual harms that happen in society. So when they tell me, I can sense what's coming. And almost inevitably, their behaviours stem often from being unable to regulate after that. And to do so, they take drugs and alcohol. So they don't feel good. They just feel less bad. So this myth about recreational drugs and the feel-good drugs, people who can cope with drugs in that way, like they do maybe drinking alcohol, well, they're very lucky. And they're not going to be addicted, because that feeling, it's just a euphoric high, and they can then spend the rest of the time working. If you've suffered significant trauma, then that is making you feel less bad, and you might want to live your life that way. I'm not encouraging it. I think it's a bad solution, but that's their solution to a massive, overwhelming problem. And their overwhelming problem is the things that have happened to them and the traumatic events that they can't understandably cope with on a day-to-day basis.
It's always been my belief that drugs are like escapism, and it's an escape for reality, you know, whether that's your current reality or, like you say, stuff that you've buried that has happened a long time in your past, unfortunately, for a lot of people. And just on the subject of sort of sexual abuse or sexual assaults, here, I'd seen Rosie Kane, who's like an ex-MSP, chatting on a podcast. I'm hoping to sort of get her on at one point. And she was saying they'd done a study in Cotton Vale at one point in time. For those who might not know, it's a female prison in Scotland, and 100% of the inmates at the time had experienced some form of sexual violence at some point in their life, which is a quite astounding stat when you think about it. And I think that sort of shows our approach to people committing crime and then punishing them by isolating them in jail is not really working when you take into account, you know, what probably is the root cause of their behaviour effectively.
Yeah, I got told today, so Scotland has the highest incarceration rate in Western Europe. We're over 8,000 prisoners at the moment. And this is despite the fact there is legislation in place and fees in place preventing short-term sentences and the use of prison, because it doesn't work. Certainly on low-level offending, it does not work. But we are around 50 places in the whole of Scotland away to having reached capacity. So imagine that. So if only 50 places, we've got about 8,000 people in the jail, we're 50 places away from the building creaking to capacity. And what we keep doing is, because we run out of clever ideas, and the same people coming in and out of our court daily, and our solution when we run out of ideas is to jail them because they run out of ideas. See the little LinkedIn post that you say you saw, and that's what attracted you to speaking to me or finding out a wee bit more about what I was doing. She was eventually jailed. She was jailed for very petty offending. And when I posted and the judge gave her a chance, and another judge decided that it had enough, because when we have enough of people that annoy us, we jail them. Not because they're dangerous, but because we find them annoying and we run out of ideas and we can't cope with them. And to me, that's very sad, because part of, I think, the thing we've got to give people as well as compassion was giving them a bit of hope. And we've also got to persevere with them, because there is no magic wand in resolving people's deep-seated trauma. And if we know what's going on with them, why would we want to stick them in jail? Even if they've behaved pretty badly, or they're impacting the community by stealing, you know, or just further isolating, or making their lives, which are awful in terms of what's going on in their head, 10 times worse. And it's, to me, it's horrific. The system, to me, is almost broken.
I would agree. We're getting to the good stuff now, Ian. It's great to hear you speak, right, about how all this sort of trauma-informed awareness and how passionate you are about it. But what's your perception then on how judges and sheriffs, who likely, in my opinion, right, not based on any study or research, but just how I perceive them, and like you say, the percentage of males and, you know, their background, like they won't have experienced much trauma themselves. So how do they feel, do you think, about this sort of trauma-informed law and being compassionate when it comes to sentencing? What's your perception of that?
So two things from that. Firstly, I don't know if that presumption is a good or healthy one. I think the best way to be properly trauma-informed is to treat everyone as if they've suffered trauma. Now, that sounds daft, but in some ways, what we're talking about is kindness, empathy, compassion, which I also think probably should be shown to judges, because we never know that. And perception might be that they're all middle class or upper class. They look down on us. They're better than us. But I don't know if that's true. So that'd be the first thing. I don't know if that's true. The second thing is, some, not all, think this whole trauma stuff is a load of pish, is a get out of jail free card, is a way to minimise very poor behaviours, is an excuse. For me, it's not about excusing behaviour, it's about explaining it and seeing if we can do something positive to reduce the harm that people who are traumatised cause, and for them, secondly, to get help and to try and recover and try and reform and try to rehabilitate. And then the other aspect to it then becomes that judges, we don't go on the presumption that judges know all this, because as I say, I spent 25 years of my career, the first 25 years, in ignorant bliss of not understanding about the impact of trauma. So the first part for me about being trauma-informed, because you could be trauma-informed all day and it make not an ounce of difference to your day and how you act as a lawyer or a judge. It's then about learning about it, understanding the impact of it, seeing that person differently. And then the most important part, as well as the awareness, is the response. So for me, the build-up should be, how are we going to be trauma responsive? What are we going to do that's going to impact that person's life? And the unfortunate thing for us professionals, when we were saying that we want these people to change, these baddies to change, the truth is that we professionals, we the lawyers, we the judges, we the prosecutors and the police, the social workers, we're the ones that have to change and do something a bit different to disrupt what is an endless pattern of poor behaviours and poor outcomes. And we keep doing the same things over and over, jailing people, punishing them, but we will not punish people into a better way of being. We will not punish people out of addiction, and we will not punish them out of behaviours which at times they can't properly control. And once we recognise that, we will hopefully start doing things that are a bit different. One of the big changes that have happened, and the biggest change which almost forces lawyers and judges to do different things, is the Young Persons Guidelines, which came out in January 2022. And what happened there, it was they changed the age of how we would view a young person in the criminal court, from those who were under 21 to those who were under 25. And the scientific reason for that was concerning the malleable brain developing up to the age of 25. Some reckon it's beyond 30, but anyway, as a start, we started treating people under 25 as young people. And as a result of that, in every court in Scotland, so the High Court, the Sheriff Court, and the Justice of the Peace Court, what the judge then requires to do is to take into account various factors in a person's background. And these include addiction, care experience, communication needs, accommodation and home environment, and importantly, childhood trauma, adverse childhood experiences. So suddenly, judges are faced with the fact that they've got to A, know about these things and take account of them, and they can't ignore them. And in getting that information, the priority then becomes rehabilitation over punishment. Now, that does not mean that judges cannot jail young people. It doesn't mean that. And quite rightly, it doesn't mean that, because some offences are people have become too dangerous to live amongst us. Okay, so that's an accepted. But the priority is about rehabilitation. So in other words, the malleable brain, that person can be, in quotations, fixed. It is not as straightforward as that, but that is the hope. But in order for that, for all of these things to happen, and the clever sentencing guidelines about young people, is what has to happen isn't overnight that person is going to change, but the system, the judges and the lawyers change. And in gaining that information and knowledge, that we react differently. And it's that part, certainly over the past 2 years, I've not greatly seen, because as I say, the numbers in the prison population have gone up. The people who are kept in Pullman Young Offenders, however, is low, comparatively low. But what happens, of course, when someone triggers at 25, 26, who've suffered all these things, then we've tried all the things for you. Your next stop's the jail. And that's how these systems work. You know, the children's referral system, the care system, the criminal justice system, and then the prison system. And what happens is this little spiral of treating children up to the age of around 15 or 16 as a wee shame, because we are empathetic with them when they're young. And when they turn 16, the same wee shame kids who are care experienced are then treated like wee shites. And that's how we treat them. We treat people as neds. We treat them as junkies. We treat them as scum. And we can punish them when we think about them that way. But as soon as we start seeing who they are and the pain and the wounds they've suffered, then for me, you have to be pretty brutal a person to want to necessarily jump in to punish them. And that's, I think, the difference.
It sounds like some progress has been made there with some of the legislation you're talking about, which is good. But as you sort of rightly pointed out, you've had back to this point about we're sort of 50 inmates away from breaching capacity. So if you could indulge us, Ian, with your sort of experience and expertise, like what if you had the power, right, if you were the Justice Secretary, you're the First Minister, what do you see as the sort of solutions here? I know there's probably no one sort of silver bullet, but what can legislators change immediately that will make a big difference to those who have obviously experienced trauma and are currently intersecting with the justice system, you know, whether that be as a defendant or anything else?
So I'd probably increase the age of criminal responsibility. It was done relatively recently from the age of 8. I mean, we used to be able to take someone who was over 8 into court and treat them as an adult. Very rarely would that ever happen, but that's been changed to the age of 12. I would probably change that age till someone was at least 15, and so that they were then dealt with through the children's hearing system, even for quite bad harms, and that they were dealt with in that way. So that would be the first change I would make. There is a very positive change that's been made very recently. CYCJ organisation at the back of legislation, I think is going through Parliament either today or very soon, which looks at, in terms of how we deal with young persons in the children's hearing system. Usually they were cut loose around the age of 16. That's going to increase to the age of 18, which again, from a justice point of view, means that we're keeping young people, youths, in the more care-based system, where the paramount consideration is the welfare of the child rather than looking at how we punish a child. And that's a different aspect. So these changes are happening gradually. The default for going to jail isn't when we run out of patience with people. So that'd be another thing. If someone is too dangerous to live amongst us in our community, then we may have to incarcerate them. We may have to take them out of society until they're safe to be amongst us. That happens now, but not only do we put those types of people in jail, we put in loads of people who struggle just in life. So for me, looking at good ways of helping people into recovery, there's always a big debate about replacement therapies. So Buvidal, methadone, various heroin replacement treatments. So we take one drug away, which is illegal, and we give people other drugs and we allow them to live and deal with their trauma by replacing one drug with another. The costlier thing to do, unfortunately, those who are able to receive help or willing to receive help, who may or may not know that they need help or can take help, would be things like looking towards therapy, looking towards increasing. We've got the highest drugs deaths in amongst the world, Scotland. We are 3 times more than England, 9 times more than the European average. So our drugs deaths are huge, in my view, because our attitude towards drugs deaths are, who cares? These people are junkies. We do not care. My view is, when you know what's happened to someone, you would very much care. You wouldn't view that person in that horrible way of naming them and stigmatising them in a way. So who I now see are people who struggle badly with mental health through trauma, who may nurse themselves with drugs and alcohol. And in knowing that, let's try and do something kinder than just replace one plaster with another plaster. Give them some hope see if there's ways to help recovery for them to understand. And that requires a lot more money and a lot more investment, which at the moment we're not prepared to give. If all these people who were dying of drug-related deaths had COVID, we would be falling over ourselves. We'd be closing everything down to stop that death. But because they, in quotations, choose to take drugs, we don't do any of these things.
Yeah,
and I think that's horrific. I don't have all the solutions. To be fair, I see a lot of the harms, and I see a lot of the things that certainly don't work. What the solutions are, I think, are very complicated, and probably require some level of tailor-made, because not everyone that suffers trauma, as I say, deals with it in the same way, or has the same difficulties, or the same ability to recover and not recover. But I've not met many people who've suffered very traumatic incidents who are unaffected. They might not take drugs, they might not abuse alcohol, they might not get angry, but they might be suffering from depression. They might live their life quietly or angrily or in various ways. So very few people come out unscathed. Many of them don't enter my world of criminal justice, but it affects a lot more people than we think.
I would agree. You're speaking my language there. One thing I was thinking about when you were talking there is the Glasgow Times did a big exposure years ago. People probably will be able to find it online if they want. And it was on the subject of methadone distribution in Glasgow. And there was a chemist right next to like Belgrove Hotel, which is sort of houses a lot of people who have got addictions effectively, and they face a lot of issues in their sort of life. And this chemist was making like an unbelievable amount of profits on this sort of methadone. So I'm definitely against that personally as well. I think there's alternatives out there that could be pursued. But I'm conscious we're sort of coming to time here. So you sort of touched on it a wee bit there as you were talking. Is this something, right, this sort of how we criminalise people who sort of commit crime, who've experienced trauma, is this something that's high up on the political agenda, effectively, without getting politicised, if that makes sense? And I'll explain what I mean there, because it seems to me, like, my perception is if left-wing type politicians start talking about this type of stuff, then those on the right just say, you're soft in crime, there's no police, there's no money and all that shite, which doesn't really help us advance as a society effectively.
You've hit the nail on the head. So talking about people who offend, people who do bad things, people who take drugs, unfortunately, is not a vote winner. So politicians fly the flag, quite understandably and rightly so in many ways, for victims of crime and how we improve their lives and how we try to get more convictions for people, for example, who commit sex offences, will remove certain things and change things in a way. That's a vote winner, because nobody wants any male or female to be sexually abused, including me. I know I make my money from people behaving badly, but I would rather people didn't commit horrendous sex crimes or even minor sex crimes. So from a voter's point of view, the changes that the Scottish Government at the moment are making are all victim-orientated. There is new legislation at the moment going through Parliament regarding a Victims and Witnesses Bill, the removal of certain things. So all these things are positive in many ways. All of these things are seen as vote winners. What are vote losers, however, would be to talk about all these clever and good things to improve the lives, on one view, of individuals by doing counterintuitive things for people who perpetrate crime. And I get why we might be against that, but it's counterintuitive to do things like be kind towards people who offend. But the longer term effect is, in doing these counterintuitive things, in my view, what I see is that there'll be a reduction of crime, therefore a reduction of victims, improvement in communities and society. But that requires a longer term vision beyond a 4-year term in Parliament. And because of that, it's not a vote winner. Some of the media, including the Red Tops, the Daily Record, I have to say, fair play to them. I'm not a big fan of tabloid media, but they have understood the drugs debate. They've understood and highlighted the drugs deaths and the horrors of that in a way that probably 10 years ago wouldn't be seen, because It would just be treated in a different way, talking about, in quotations, junkies and Neds. That doesn't seem to hold true now. But as I say, as a vote winner, it's hard to explain to people in a 3-second clip that politicians have got to use about the impact of trauma and why we need to do something counterintuitive. It's much easier to say hard and soft on crime rather than smart on crime. And these are the tags, unfortunately, that lead us into a situation where change, in my view, will be very slow. And as I say, I hope to see bigger changes. But in my sort of career over the past 6 years, I've seen some very positive outcomes. They're trying to change courts. So that part of that act is one of the headlines in it is, henceforth, all tribunals in Scotland will be trauma-informed. It's pretty meaningless, to be fair, but as a concept, it's really good. But really, it's only affecting victims and witnesses. But actually, if you were trauma-informed generally in terms of how you treat someone in court, including accused persons, so treating them with dignity and respect, which seems counterintuitive, then the buy-in from those people who commit offences might actually be pretty good, because throughout their lives, they've been told they're bad, they've been told they're scum, and they're criminals, so we tag and label them. But if you treat someone in a different way, which is counterintuitive, you find you'll get a better response. In life generally, as a human being, you'll get a better response. But in a criminal justice system, my view, generally, you'll get a much better response. And I see that certainly in my local court, the way the police officers in my local court in West Lothian treat people. They treat them, by and large, as best they can, with dignity and respect, and they understand about the impact of trauma and sexual abuse, and they treat people equally and decently. And I don't always see that across the board in Scotland.
No, that's interesting stuff in there. You mentioned the sort of tribunals training. Like, I've had experience of going to court as I don't know what the sort of technical term here, but Noah is somebody who's been prosecuted. Somebody who was a victim, I suppose, is the word I'm looking for here. And it was a poor experience, to put it mildly. I don't think that there is much knowledge in my own personal experience of the court that I was sort of involved with in sense of trauma and how can it impact somebody. And I don't think that's a personal experience either. We've seen it in the news in the past sort of couple of weeks, and people are obviously trying to make changes there. But I think that's probably a whole other topic. We're coming to sort of the end of your time here, Ian, so can maybe get into another podcast maybe.
Your listeners might end up falling asleep with hearing my voice.
No, that was good. Do you need to go, Ian? Is that us done? Because we're at 2 o'clock now.
I can keep going just now, so
right,
that's okay.
One sort of thing, and you don't need to answer this, right, but I presume you probably get answered it quite a lot. So you talked a wee bit about the ethics earlier of being a defence lawyer, so hypothetically, sort of, would you mind talking about that and indulging a wee bit? What I was thinking was, like, if you had discovered that one of your clients or somebody who was trying to come in and get you to take on, them as a client, had sort of systematically abused someone who they knew suffered from, say, PTSD or a lot of adverse trauma through their life, would that be a red line for you? Like, if you thought they were thoroughly a bad person and dangerous, would that lead you to sort of not represent them effectively?
No. So, I mean, a lot of people will ask me, loosely speaking, the same question, which is, how can you defend folk like that? And the reality is, my job is to act as a lawyer, and I'll act for anyone. So a large proportion of my clients will be guilty of horrendous offences, abusing children, raping women, killing people, horrific levels of violence, fraud, embezzlement. So whoever they are, they'll come in, and I hope and I try my best. It doesn't always work, but I try to treat everybody the same. I'm not the judge, so I try to avoid judgment. And I hear what their position is, I give them legal advice, and I deal with the case. Sometimes you can be conflicted by, for example, knowing the victim or complainer, as we call them in Scotland, and that might mean that I have an existing client, because often there's a lot of crossover between those who are victims of crime and those who are perpetrators of it. I think most of my clients who I see spend longer being victims of crime than they do perpetrators of it. And again, that's something quite hard to get your head around. But so if I'm conflicted from a professional point of view, and then I won't be able to act. but I certainly don't decide on anyone, whatever flavour of crime they have committed, to say, well, I'm not acting for you because you're horrible. But if I did that, I wouldn't have very much business. And I don't think I'd be a particularly good lawyer if that's how I proceeded. And you know, as I say, the nature of my job means I encounter people who have done horrific things. What I've also encountered and not realised is I've not met many people who I find horrific. And there is a slight difference with that, and I know that might make people uncomfortable, but I've not met many people who I would regard as thoroughly evil or bad, and the ones that were certainly were very, very mentally ill, psychiatrically ill. Most people I deal with, I find some redeeming feature in. What they do is horrific. Domestic abuse of their partners repeatedly, I find horrific. Sexual abuse, horrific. All these different crimes are horrific. So I don't ever like or view what they've done in any positive light. I think all crime shouldn't happen, but when it does, how they react and treat the person, I hopefully try and treat them with a bit of dignity and respect. I listen to their position and I advocate for them in court without fear or favour. That's what I try and do, and all criminal lawyers, I think, endeavour to do that.
Aye, oh, fair enough. So it's heavy sort of subject matter today, Ian, obviously. So, like, have you ever seen this judge, Frank Capiro, just to make it a wee bit lighter? Have you seen any of his videos online? There's like a judge.
Yeah. He's like probably a level of justice of the peace here, and he does very creative things, and he's obviously very empathetic and sympathetic to a lot of people. The slight difficulty with that is, you see, they get the example of the lady who's parked her car on a double yellow line, and he decides because she's struggling with life that he's going to forego the $50 fine, and he gets a round of applause, and that's great. But probably what we don't see is other 49 people who might be equally struggling who've had to pay the fine. So if we have rules and guidance, probably consistency is important. Taking into account people's circumstances, I think, is equally important. But there are certain difficulties. My advocacy about what I'm talking about with trauma isn't about being soft on people. It's being a bit wise or smart about how we go forward to make sure we try to make sure it doesn't happen again. But I think, he's a good judge and a kind man, a nice man. But as I say, these are low-level offences that he's dealing with, where he has the power to do something kind and nice, and that's a great thing. I don't think I'd be a particularly good judge. I don't know if I'd be particularly soft either. But I don't know if I'd be a particularly good judge. I think I'd find it hard to sit in judgment of people. So the good thing being a criminal defence lawyer is I don't sit in judgment of people, or I try not to. It's not a perfect scheme. I sometimes might not like someone naturally. I might not do all the trauma-informed things I should do by not being annoyed with someone who starts calling me, tells me to fuck off. Because human nature kicks in for me as well, that I don't particularly like someone being aggressive towards me or violent or rude. And when it happens, you don't always follow or practice what you preach.
I know, we're all human at the end of the day. So is there anything that we've not discussed, Ian, that you wanted to kind of flag to, like, maybe the sort of the Scottish audience here? Have we covered kind of what you were...
Yeah. I think it's important for your students. So, you know, whatever they're studying, psychology, sociology, law, medicine, medical... I mean, the trauma-informed stuff is an interesting thing to understand. An important thing to understand from a human nature point of view, just in life generally, but from a professional life point of view, I think it's quite a buzzy word to be trauma-informed, which, as I say, if you're not acting on, is almost irrelevant, because you're gaining all that knowledge and doing nothing about it. And it's all about how you change and what you do and how you treat people. And that's where I think we'll notice the biggest impact if everybody dealt with it in that way and being a bit kinder to people. I know it sounds a bit weak, but the reality is that outcomes for those who are most impacted at an outcome for you as a professional or person who does behave in a different way, I think will be more positive. So that's probably the biggest takeaway thing I'd want people to understand is be trauma-informed all day long is irrelevant. How you respond to that is the biggest thing.
No, interesting. I should say as well, like, I'm not officially affiliated with the university. I just, I was a student here and they built a purpose sort of built podcast room. I just used that to host the podcast. But obviously, I've sort of made a note to it in the name and stuff like that. And obviously, I want to interview faculty staff every now and again, stuff like that. But it's not an official partnership or anything like that. But
That's okay.
We might have students listening anyway. But that was amazing. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this and taking time out of your day. Kind of shows the kind of person you are, I think. This is like episode 9, I think, now that we've done of this. So if people enjoyed it, you know, like and follow, that kind of stuff. And again, just thanks for doing this, mate.
Good luck to you, and thanks for letting me speak to you.
Right, no worries. Cheers, Ian.